Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Gottfried Straight, No Chaser. I am so honored this evening to introduce you to a completely different kind of idiom this evening from a place that I know very well. Born in Manhattan, raised in Harlem, played on the PAL streets on 153rd Street. I am a proud, proud New Yorker. And this evening, we will be talking to a wonderful woman who has created an organization to bring such wonderful classical music to Harlem. And it is called the Harlem Chamber Players. And her name is Liz Player. But before I get to Liz Player, you know I always do a little housekeeping. So everyone will know, and the board is beginning to fill up already, how to call in and how to ask if you want to ask a question. First thing, you are listening to blogtalkradio.com/S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. If you want to hear any of the past archived conversations, you can then go to that address, click on it, and then choose, scroll down to all of the different conversations that are there. And tonight, if you want to call in and ask a question, say hello, find out how we're doing, it is 516-453-6063. And to ask a question, you have to press the number 1. And so with that, we all know over the weeks, and we've been doing this now for a while. I've been doing Lenny Gottfried Straight No Chaser for just about 70 episodes. And to get the opportunity to talk to someone who is connecting me with what was a wonderful childhood memories of where I lived and then the beauty of what is developing there is a very, very important thing to me. So I have to say to you, I'm very excited about this. Having been raised in Harlem, gone to private school, the Martin School, up in what they call Sugar Hill, and then moving on to the wonderful, magnificent George Washington High School, and then going to Hampton University, past that, and going, finishing at Hunter College. So I am a New York doll, and this is a New York organization, and we are very, very proud of it. First, let me tell you a little bit about the wonderful lady who has really started this organization from the ground up. It was founded by, and I want to say this correctly, clarinetist Liz Player. Now, Liz founded this organization, but first it was not called the Harlem Chamber Players. It was formulated with the late violinist Charles Dalton, who she met while performing at a gala concert in New York City for the New York City Housing Symphony Orchestra. But it was inspired by Janet Wolfe, who's a longtime patron of the arts of color. And in 2008, the idea started. And then once she got this idea, it started formulated. And how she formulated this, she has a wonderful background in so many different diverse industries. First, she has a bachelor's background in computer science, and then she worked in marketing and events, and that included panels on the New York State Council on the Arts, the New York Department of Cultural Affairs, and the panels of diversifying orchestral music in New York City. So I would say that with that introduction, we are talking to someone who has a wonderful background in music, in the industry, and can guide us as to what she's created in Harlem, and then tell her us a lot about how the music has been influential in her life and how, why she has gotten to where it is. So we have a face later on in the after show afterthoughts to connect to all this conversation. So with that said, I'd like to say good evening, Miss Liz Player. How are you this evening?
Thank you so much, Lenny, and it's an honor to be here. I'm doing very well, and I'm very happy to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I am honored to talk to you because I am a product of the Harlem community, and it is, and we have several people on my panel. I recognize the numbers now of people who grew up in Harlem, and we are so very, very proud that there is a diversity of thought about what can come out of that section of Manhattan. So we're going to get to that. But before we get to that, I mean, I've read all your accomplishments, and it goes on and on and on and on how wonderful and devoted you are to this organization and to your career. I'd like you to tell me, Liz Player, how do you describe yourself? Not the accomplishments that you've done, but you.
Oh, myself. I have to say, I think I love people. I tend to be pretty friendly, and I love bringing people together. But I wasn't always this way. I grew up very shy and had very little confidence in myself growing up. So I tend to not like being out in public, but ever since I started this series, I've had to learn how to come out and speak more. So this is actually new for me to just be able to come out and speak to you on your show out in public. And what else do I like to do? I'm interested in a lot of things, the arts, obviously music I really love, and that's about it.
Well, you know, that's a lot. That's about it. So tell me, where did it start for you? Are you from New York City? Are you from the area? Tell me a little bit about your background, your parents, the influence of the arts that got you to where we are, so then we can celebrate the Harlem Chamber Players. Because there's so much information. There's so many programs that people have to look forward to attend. So we're going to get to all of that. But first, you and you, how you created this. So let's start from the beginning. Where are you from?
Sure. I grew up in South Jersey, but mainly I'm an Army brat. My father was African-American. He served in the Army, and we lived in Japan and Korea as well. So actually, my first language was not even English. My mother is Korean. My father met my mother while he was stationed over there. And so Korean was my first language. Fortunately, at the time, it wasn't popular to be bilingual. So they wound up speaking English to me. And so I had a hard time in kindergarten and first grade learning English. But I remember my father, while we lived in Japan, we lived on an army base, and he played in a band called the People's Power. And he had those old red, black, and green jumpsuits. I wish I could find it because I just have fond memories.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Okay. All right. I'm just picturing.
My father, he loved to sing. And, he played a lot of R&B growing up, jazz. He tried to get me to listen to a lot of jazz. I wish I paid more attention when I was younger, but I was immature then. But, he loved Marvin Gaye, Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, you know, just all of that music. So there was always a lot of music in our house. And I remember there were times when he had to be away from home. This is going up a little bit when we came back to the States. And I once found that I remember whenever he would come home, he would start playing Stevie Wonder's My Cherie Amour. And, you know, to this day, that music stays in my head. So I think that's where I got my love of music, definitely from my father. My mother wasn't as into music as he was. You know.
I see.
And,
but now, there's a long ways from Stevie Wonder to being a clarinetist. So now you have to bridge a gap. Now. I mean, and he's brilliant. But so how did that evolution happen? You say your mother wasn't that musical, but something happened that drew you to music. And when did that happen?
So from first grade on, we settled down in South Jersey in a little town, Burlington Township. And
Yes. Mm-hmm. I know it very well. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I used
to live in friend. Where did
go
you
ahead?
Live?
Clinton.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
All right.
Yeah, right next
to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right. Great. My best friend Sally, who lived across the street from me, played the clarinet, and so I started the clarinet at the age of 11. And you know, that's one of those instruments you can start a little bit later. I know violinists and pianists can start very young, maybe even mm-hmm. four or even younger sometimes. So mm-hmm. I played clarinet, and our school, you know, it was a modest neighborhood. And I remember the band teacher in middle school and high school, his name was Michael Wojciechowicz, and we all called him Mr. W. He loved big band music. So we wound up playing, you know, band music, Glenn Miller and, you know, medleys and Sousa marches. So that's the music that I learned at the time. But I started excelling at the clarinet. And then I don't remember how we learned about it, but there was a youth orchestra not far away from Princeton. It was actually in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And mm-hmm. there was a small set of us, about four of us, who would carpool. I don't remember whether I had to audition. I don't remember how I got into the orchestra. Maybe I had to audition. And that's where I played, I think, from 10th through 12th grade. And that's where I really learned about classical music. You know, I learned who Rimsky-Korsakov was. And at the time, I remember we played this piece, Scheherazade. And I saw the way it was spelled on paper, and I kept calling it Scheherazade. And my father laughed at me. I don't know how he knew, but he said, no, it's Scheherazade. And I could say, no, it's Scheherazade. And, you know, so, you know, it took a while because my parents didn't grow up. I didn't grow up with classical music. And I remember we also used to go to the Burlington County Library, and mm-hmm. I started looking through albums, and I started borrowing music by Handel. And I remember listening to trio sonatas, and I just started falling in love with that music.
That sounds now you're out of high school. So what college choice did you make, and did you make it for music alone? Was there an additional subject that you decided to accompany the music? How did that decision start to formulate your life?
I just remember when it came time to start thinking about what colleges to go to. My parents were really worried about how much I loved music and about my going into music. And, you know, it's that old battle between doing something practical and doing what you love. And
absolutely.
In the end, mm-hmm. So in the end, my guidance counselor and my parents convinced me to go study something that would be more practical. And so I went to Rutgers College and decided to study computer science. I hated it. I'll be honest, it was a lot of work, and I became a programmer analyst for 8 years before I decided to leave and return to music.
That must have been hard. In those 8 years, did you go to concerts? Did you attempt to be in the music world, or did you just concentrate on the computer science?
I focused for a little while. I remember my first job was at AT&T in Basking Ridge, and mm-hmm. I was there for, now I'm trying to remember, how long was I there? Maybe 3 years. And mm-hmm. then I And I started, you know, playing the clarinet, but I couldn't find a good clarinet teacher where I live. And so I thought, well, New York, you know, that's where artists go. So I really, I had my heart set on moving to New York. And trust me, I, you know, South Jersey, the school I went to was so small. We only had 5 hallways. There were 140 people in my graduating class. So when I went to Rutgers, I thought New Brunswick was like a big city. So you can just imagine how I felt when I moved to New York.
Yeah.
And so I decided to come to New York, and I got a job at J.J. Kenney, and I think I stayed there for 5 years. And I met my first classical clarinet teacher. His name was David Glazer. He passed away years ago. And I started studying with him, and I really missed it. And I remember working really hard at it. And he suggested that I think about going back into music. And so I did. And I wound up going to Queens College. With musicians, especially classically trained musicians, they want you to be much younger. So Queens College was a place that was friendly for older students. And so I sold my furniture and I quit my job at J.J. Kenney. I got into Queens College and started over with the second bachelor in music in clarinet performance.
Now you graduated, but you graduated magna cum laude from Queens, didn't you?
I did well. I did well every semester. I had I have to admit I was really conflicted with myself. So I should have graduated in 4 years, but there were just 2 requirements that I never fulfilled. One was a phys ed class, and one was some sort of history class. So just because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I loved chamber music, but there were no real jobs in chamber music. I didn't like orchestral music as much. So I wasn't sure where I fit in the music scene. So I floated around for a while, and I actually wound up living in different worlds. I had one foot in music and 1 foot back into doing something that I thought would be practical. So I just kept up with, you know, just practical skills, you know, and I wound up working temp jobs. And then eventually, I think I wound up getting a job at the New York Stock Exchange. But at the same time, I still continued to play music. But what I really loved more than anything else was chamber music. And there's, I didn't know how to make money at that. I would take gigs. But for chamber music to stay in shape, I formed a wind quintet. And then later I would put together recitals once a year just to make sure I would stay in shape. And I would include solo clarinet works with piano as well as 1 significant chamber music piece just to stay in shape. And and during that time, while I was at Queens College, I, you know, some good things happened. I had I had the opportunity to go to Manchester Music Festival, which was really wonderful, and spend the summer up in beautiful Vermont just playing chamber music. I had the opportunity at Queens College. I auditioned to play solo with the orchestra, so I got to play the beautiful Debussy Premier Rhapsody for clarinet and orchestra. And I had a chance to play the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with the Greenwich Village Orchestra. So there were some opportunities. But, you know, I was just sort of living a double life.
And so you are preaching to, the choir, because you are, you should know you're in the company of people who are listening, and myself, of those of us who chose the arts but had parents who wanted us to be very practical. We chose to be able to excel in the academics to please them, but the hunger of the arts never went away. So I understand your journey. I'm following you now step by step. So now you're in the double life, but ultimately you made a decision when to really step into the musical life, the art life. And how difficult was that for you? I think it's so fascinating for the audience to hear this because people don't understand our journey a whole lot. You know, they
right.
kind of they think it's Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. You know, let's put a band and let's, you know, just build a show and let's go. You know, those choices. So when did that fork in the road come when you decided to go into a whole nother path? When did that happen?
I have to say, up until now, I mean, I've always had what was a day job. But what happened was eventually the New York Exchange was bought out by the Intercontinental Exchange. And, so a lot of layoffs happened there. I was eventually laid off, and I was glad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started teaching. But there was one place, and I had to temp because it was hard for me to make any money. But it was while I was at the New York Stock Exchange that I started the Harlem Chamber Players. So I was doing that while I was working there. And then in 2015, this is jumping up some, that's when I left the New York Stock Exchange. But at the time, my father got really ill, so I spent some time taking care of him.
Mm-hmm.
But I wound up in 2016 working at the Ford Foundation. And I have to say, I was thinking of it at first as a day job. I temped there, but I fell in love with that place. And there I learned about philanthropy. They make grants there. So I'm on the other end, you know, I'm learning about how grants are made by a major foundation. And
mm-hmm.
so I was fortunate to work with really good managers there who supported my musical endeavor. So while I was at the New York Stock Exchange, I felt like I had to sort of not talk about my music or just be sort of an automaton, you know, a different person. But I remember when I went to the Ford Foundation, my manager and the directors I had all encouraged us all to bring our hotels to work. So I was able to talk about the Harlem Chamber Players and to just be who I am while I was working there. So I actually continued to work during the day, actually until Friday. I actually just now resigned from the Ford Foundation.
Oh my gosh, this is a celebratory kind of thing. Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just on Friday. You know, what happened was, you know, and I worked hard and I really loved it there. And, you know, there's a part of me that still didn't have enough confidence in what I was doing. But somehow during the pandemic, in the last fiscal year, our operating budget doubled. We made some sort of breakthrough, and we started getting attention from foundations, but
mm-hmm.
I still didn't have enough confidence, and I wound up applying or, you know, interviewing. I was a program assistant there, and I got promoted to grants manager, and I really liked it, but what happened was things got incredibly, overwhelmingly busy. And one of the foundations, a place I went to where I asked for a renewal of a grant, the program officer there was so generous and thought, well, you know, this fund is closing, and gave us a large grant, that salary for the next couple of years, which is pretty amazing.
Excellent.
And
yeah.
I'm not going to lie, you know, I'm in a place now where I'm feeling happy and sad at the same time, because as far as jobs go, out of all the places I've been, I really loved working at the Ford Foundation. So it was actually quite painful to leave. But, you know, I'm also happy at the same time, because this is actually the first time I'm getting to do something that I really love. And so it's just now that the door's opening up where I can just focus solely on the Harlem Chamber Players. As I was building up the group, I had less and less time to practice the clarinet, so I've sort of given up playing the past several years. So that's something I'm looking forward to, is reconnecting with the clarinet and what I love.
Oh, this is fascinating. It's like watching a birth happening. I mean, mm-hmm. really, because the beginning of the beginning of your really making the decision to make this a priority in your life. And I do understand when you do have support, like being in a Ford Foundation, that's a very secure feeling that,
yes.
And it's not just not just the job, but there are people who are, I don't want to use the word approve, but that's the one that comes to mind right now. People who approve and understand exactly what it is that you're doing. And that is a very comfortable place to be. And how brave of you to say, okay, but I'm going to go out of my comfort zone. You should be very, very proud of yourself, Liz. I'm very proud of you, and I haven't even met you yet, really. You know, but I'm very proud to come out of your comfort zone and say, you know, now I've created this environment, and now I can actually, I'm feeling comfortable enough that I can do this full time. That's an incredible accomplishment for most of us who are in the arts, because it's not an easy thing to do. It's really not. So I congratulate you on that. But now, so this brings me to the Harlem Chamber Players. So you were formulating it even more while in your Ford Foundation. How explain to me what that formulation was. Because, you know, it's so wonderful to hear from the beginning how something like this is happening and all the progress and all the wonderful music that you all have created. So how did that happen? Did you audition musicians on the weekend? How did the Chamber Players start?
We started back in 2008. And that was actually right before I started working at the New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time, you know, that's when we had the crash. The
mm-hmm.
economy was not good.
Right.
And it was during the summer of 2008. I had just met the violist, Charles Dawson, the late violist. He's passed away since then. And we played together at one of Janet Wolf's gala concerts in support of her New York City Housing Symphony Orchestra. And I told him my dreams. At the time, I told you I had recitals once a year. I had a wind quintet. But I love music for clarinet and strings. And here I met a violist. And I'm telling him what I would love to do. I have played at this church, St. Mary's Church on 126th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. And
mm-hmm.
it's a small, lovely church. I fell in love with it. I played there in 2004 with an old roommate and some other people I met. And later I moved to that neighborhood, and that's the first place I thought of where we would start our chamber music series. We were overly ambitious, and during the summer of 2008, we decided we would have a music festival, a four concert, and we just called it Music at St. Mary's. We didn't have mm-hmm. a name for the group at the time. And so
mm-hmm.
we had four concerts, which was tough. And Raoul Abdul, who was a music critic for the Amsterdam News, was excited about this. And so he came and supported us. But our first concert, where we thought we would just come in and create a storm in Harlem, there was a thunderstorm. And I think people showed up to the concert. My mother, my father, and just a handful of friends. And
uh-huh.
my heart, I just, you know, it was hurtful.
Yes.
But,
yes.
You know, yes. Nobody knew who we were. And, you know, when I think about it, there was another part of me that was intimidated, because here we are, you know, Harlem is already rich with culture, rich with history. I mean, there's jazz, R&B, literature, and, you know, so much already happening in Harlem. So here we are, we're thinking we're going to bring classical music up into Harlem and do something. But we went on, we continued that summer. And by the third concert, we had maybe between 60 to 70 people, which is a lot for a classical chamber music concert. And we entered that season, and at the time, the Reverend Earl Cooper Camp, who was the rector at the time, you know, he loved the series, and we continued and started making it a regular season. I had my differences with Charles at the time, and then I met my partner, Carl Jackson, and so we split with Charles, and then the next year, Carl came, became my partner, my life partner, and my partner in creating this series. And so the name of my wind quintet was called West Harlem Winds. We were trying to think of what we should name our group. Said, no, call it the Harlem Chamber Players. Like, why not take all of Harlem, you know? And so, I felt really shy about it. But then I thought, okay, yeah, let's do it. So we named the group the Harlem Chamber Players then.
And you all have really, in this time period, you all have played a lot of different places. I'm going to say some of these places so that, because some people should know that that you played them, and maybe they've heard you and just were not, they're not making that connection. But you played in the Aaron Davis Hall, the Apollo Theater, Schomburg Center for the Research in Black Culture, Brooklyn Museum, the Isaac Stern Auditorium at Carnegie, and New Jersey Symphony Space, just to name a couple of places that you all have done. And that was before your epiphany of now really just getting out there and doing everything on your own. I want to encourage people to go on YouTube and to listen, to find the Harlem Chamber Players, and to listen specifically, there's one that I really love called Pity These Ashes. And it is about the disaster in Greenwood, Oklahoma. And people who know me know that I've been involved in the reading and directing the reading of Celeste Bedford Walker's Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed. So I want people to go on YouTube and listen to it. It's 58 minutes long, and I want you to tell them why that title and what the other programs that are coming up are, especially the Ordering of Moses, all of these things. Don't think that I haven't been on you. I've been on you. I'm so excited about all of these wonderful programs that, you know, you all and the composers that you support, the conductors that you support. Tell us a little bit about the title of Pity These Ashes, but then go on and tell us what's coming up, so that and believe it or not, we have less than 20 minutes left. I told you it goes fast, but
it sure does.
But I wanted people to understand how it was created. So now that they will get, when they hear the name and they have an association, they will follow you. So tell us now about Pity These Ashes and the Ordering of Moses and all of the panels that you have scheduled. Go on, please.
Sure. I just want to say that one person who really changed our way of thinking, not just Carl Jackson, but very early on, Terrence McKnight, who is a radio host on W2XR, he is now our artistic advisor, and he's played a major influence in the way he started programming, because at first, you know, we were playing Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart, but we needed to learn about Black composers, and so Terrence is very educated and knows about these Black composers. But I grew up not knowing who William Grant Still was, or Florence Price, or Samuel Coleridge Taylor, or even Chevalier de St. George. I didn't know any of these composers growing up. And I didn't know any of my Black history, too. I grew up in South Jersey, and we had our history was watered down. So as I got to know Terrence more, and he's helping us curate, and I'm getting more ideas from him, I started really listening a lot more to Black composers. And exactly. So one person, and Adolphus Hale Stork, who's very much alive today, who's a wonderful composer, and we're good friends. Back in 2019, we commissioned a piece. He wrote a piece that commemoration of 1619. So it was parents who got me thinking of creating more culturally relevant programs. If we're going to be in Harlem, we've got to bring music for our people. And so, you know, and looking at history, so, and it was Adolphus Hailstork, Professor Hailstork got me thinking of history. So I thought, oh, here we are coming into 2021. It's the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And that was something when I heard about that, just, you know, it was so painful for several reasons because of what happened, but because we didn't know about it, you know, I didn't even, it wasn't even in our history book.
No,
and
it,
so
it wasn't.
Not
until 2018 was it mandated that it be in the state of Oklahoma. It was mandated that it be taught. So there were people in Oklahoma who knew nothing about it. So, yes.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, that's just downright shameful. But, and you know, so I reached out to Professor Hailstork, and I asked if he would write a piece in commemoration of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And at the time, we partnered with Harlem Stage and the wonderful mezzo-soprano. So he wrote the piece for her with a chamber orchestra. And the name of his piece, he called Tulsa 1921 and subtitled Pity These Ashes, Pity This Dust. So that's where the title of the entire concert came from. And then I started thinking of other pieces to pair with it. And I listened to music by Trevor Weston, who's also another amazing Black composer. And there's a piece he wrote called The People Could Fly. And this is for narrator, solo violin, and string orchestra. And that is a story based on the African-American folktale with the same name. And then we also perform a piece by Jesse Montgomery and also by Alice Coltrane. And that was the entire program, which culminated in the Hailstork piece called Tulsa 1921. But the Pity These Ashes was Tulsa 1921 to 2021 was what we called the entire concert because we wanted to dedicate it. We wanted it to be in remembrance of what happened in Tulsa 100 years ago.
Well, I encourage people, if there is a replication of it on YouTube, and it's absolutely lovely. I advise you to take the time, put it on, and just listen. It's really, really beautiful. Now, tell us what is coming up for the Harlem Chamber Players, the conversations, the concerts, what's up?
Oh, I'm excited about this one. We were supposed to do this in June of 2020. This concert coming up on June 17 at 7:30 at the Riverside Church is called The Ordering of Moses because the Harlem Renaissance composer Nathaniel Dett's monumental oratorio called The Ordering of Moses. And this is, for this, we're going to have over 100 performers. We'll have a 75-member choir, a 60-plus piece orchestra, 5 Met Opera soloists, and the IMG performing artist Damian Sneed will lead the orchestra as our music director and conductor. And then we'll also have a surprise performance as part of that. We're going to start the concert with a new arrangement by Damian Sneed of Lift Every Voice and Sing, and then a very short chorus by Bach. We still love Bach. And end with this oratorio. And this is, and you know what? I think, although I was devastated we didn't do it in 2020, I think now, 2 years later, this piece will have much more meaning because it's the story of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt after a series of plagues. So here we are in the midst of a pandemic. And so I'm thinking this is a piece that we're going to call out and and just lead us out of the pandemic. That is my hope, at least.
Well, it sounds absolutely wonderful. And that, now you also have, isn't there a panel piece that's going to go on? Is that?
That's correct. Prior to this concert on Wednesday, June 15th at 6 p.m., we'll be at Manhattan School of Music, their Miller Recital Hall, and there's going to be a panel discussion leading up to this main event. And this discussion is called The Long Road to Freedom. And it's going to talk about Black liberation. I mean, you know, we're coming into Juneteenth, which will be the first anniversary of this being a national holiday. And so mm-hmm. this panel will talk about what Black liberation means. We'll have the Reverend Malcolm Bird of Mother AME Zion on the panel, as well as Rabbi Tavi Koslow, a Jewish scholar from the Ideas School. And so we'll get perspectives from a scholarly perspective and also Christian as well as the Jewish perspective on what freedom means and the story of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot there that we'll talk about. And Terrence McKnight of WQXR and Damian Sneed will be on this panel. And Alexa Smith from Manhattan School of Music will be the moderator.
I see. So there's a busy schedule coming up. With all of this happening, now where do you see this all going for yourself? At what point in time? Because at this point in time, you don't have a specific place that you call home. Would you like to have one like that? Would you want a brick and mortar? Do you want to be able to have the flexibility to move around? Tell me how you feel about that.
Yes, that's something we're working on, but that's going to be down the road. So right now, we do the administrative work out of our home, and we have some other people who work with us, and we're all remote at this time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a home, and we like to perform in different venues. So here we'll be at the Riverside Church, but you know, we have partnerships with, we're artists in residence at Harlem School of the Arts. We mm-hmm. usually give an annual Black History Month concert at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, while we hope to have the brick and mortar, you know, we need to grow a little bit more. We're starting to grow now, but we're not quite there yet.
I know that the concern about in live, in-person performances is always because we are still in a pandemic. I want to tell the audience that that there is going to be a protocol in place so that everyone
yes.
can be.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that so that people will know that they're comfortable when they go in. They can that there is something in place for them to encourage them to attend these things. Why don't you tell us what you have planned?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I just want everyone to know that we had to make the tough decision to require that even the choir, every choir member will be wearing masks. The orchestra will be masked, except for wind and brass players who obviously need to use, you know, they can't be masked while they're playing. And
mm-hmm.
Only the five soloists and the conductor will not be wearing masks. But other than that, and the surprise performers will also be masked. We're strongly recommending that people who attend this concert be vaccinated. And we're also, we will ask that people be masked. It's actually a requirement at the Riverside Church that in their public spaces, people wear masks, and we'll make sure to enforce that.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes people far more comfortable to know that there is an enforcement of protocol, and
sure.
that's an important element that we as performers, should insist upon to make our audiences feel safe and feel comfortable to come and see the entertainment. So that's really kind of wonderful about that. Now, do you think coming into Harlem with this wonderful idea of reinforcing classical music, because there's been classical music in Harlem before, mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas of outreach for young students? I know where I am now, I belong to an organization called Friends of Music, and it encourages students the enhancement and the sustaining of classical music. Do you have any program that is now going to reach out to our young children in Harlem to encourage those children who are interested in the classics to continue and sustain their interest in it?
Absolutely, and we really want to grow our educational outreach. Actually, those are the next steps that we're building upon. As I told you, we're artists in residence at the Harlem School of the Arts. We have an ongoing partnership with Opus 118 Harlem School of Music, where we have an annual side-by-side concert with them where our professional musicians play along with the musicians in concert. And just this past April, for the first time, we introduced the students of the Harlem School of the Arts with the students from Opus 118 Harlem School of Music. We didn't get everyone to play together yet because there were some fears around COVID, but we did come together in concert, and we hope to continue that partnership, and we want to branch out from there. Some other things that we do, though, is we give educational concerts where we introduce students to Black composers who are underrepresented in the canon, because everyone thinks that of Brahms and Beethoven, but people don't know that Chevalier de St. George actually influenced Mozart. They lived under the same roof for a little bit when Mozart was very young, and at the time Joseph Boulogne was also known as Chevalier de St. George, was very popular and was already doing very well. And, you know, composers such as Samuel Coleridge Taylor and so many others.
Well, you know, I think my a while ago, I think last year, year and a half ago, there was a concert in Houston that I was invited to attend. And they were concentrating on the female composers, Black female composers that really did not get a lot, have not gotten a lot of recognition, that for years were conducting plays, were conducting orchestras and writing for them and all of that. So just revealing all of that information that that we have in our history is going to be absolutely wonderful for that. As we enter into the last 10 minutes, that's all we have about, in fact, no, we have about 7 minutes left. Is there any question that I have not asked you about yourself or about the Harlem Chamber Players that you would like to be asked or like the audience to know about?
You've been very thorough, but I do want to stress that I just want to make sure that people do check out our website, www.harlemchamberplayers.org. And to check out our upcoming concert, The Ordering of Moses. We really want people to come to this because I really think this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's a rarely performed piece. And the way this composer sprinkles Go Down Moses throughout the entirety of this oratorio is just really magnificent. And I think it's going to be something that's uplifting, and it'll as well. So I just really want to push that. But otherwise, I actually think you've been quite thorough.
Well, thank you. I wanted so badly to be able to extract some of the music, but it wasn't possible to extract it from the YouTube piece. So that's why I'm trying to encourage people to go and sample themselves. And you know, at one point in time, you may not be able to hear it all at the same time, but do sample. This is a wonderful, wonderful ensemble of very gifted musicians. And it's just beautiful music to listen to. Tell me this, with all of that, with all of your concentration on the classical chamber music, how do you feel about the music of today? How do you feel about the rap music? Or now, I know you were raised on the same kind of rhythm and blues music that I feel, so I'm partial to that. But The other kind of, you were talking about your father wanted to emphasize and interest you into jazz. How do you feel about those kinds of different kinds of the idioms of music that exists?
I think that who said that? I think maybe Duke Ellington said, or Robin Bell Stevens actually quoted this to me. She said there's only two kinds of music, the good kind and the other kind. And so I love all kinds of music.
I understand what they mean. Yeah.
So I love all kinds of music. My partner, he loves listening to trap music, and he's been introducing me to some of it. I'm just not as familiar with it. But, you know, I have some friends who say, you've got to listen to some hip music. It'll help you with your classical playing. So I think we need to just broaden our horizons. And there's actually a trend that's happening in classical music. You've heard it. Imani Wins has been doing it for a long time. There's this wonderful group, Public Quartet. And even composers, you mentioned women composers. Jessie Montgomery infuses the Black vernacular into her music, as does Nkiru Okoye. And so you're starting to hear music that's starting to cross genres, you know. So is it really classical? It sounds like, you know, there's other music in there. But even back then, even this composer Nathaniel Dett for The Ordering of Moses infused Black spirituals. And people don't know the Czech composer Dvorak actually came and listened to this Black baritone. And when he introduced what was called the American sound, it was because he was influenced by what he said was Negro melodies, which he actually predicted would become the basis of the future of music in America. And at the time, he was ridiculed for saying that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know one of my favorite stories is about Florence Price. And I think I think people don't realize how influential she was as a composer. And, you know, in classical music, that the presence of women in classical music was very, very strong. There weren't a whole lot of them, but when they were there,
right.
so like cement in the sidewalk. They made their impression, and they were brilliant in their own way. I really want to encourage people to broaden their horizons about our history and our involvement of history, not only in the more popular kinds of music and music that we hear now, but to also familiarize yourself with our historical figures and those that are not the ones that you hear, the 12 names that you hear over and over and over again, but go and go outside of your box and then really try to Google. Just make a category and Google and look these people up, because they are there and they've contributed so beautifully to what we have to enjoy today. You know, that's a really important, I think, element that I'd like to encourage people to do, that I'd like musicians, when they're talking to young people, to encourage them to do, to envelop not only the classical music, but tell them to look up all kinds of music, and then classical music will fall into it, you know. But I have to say, in these last few minutes, you may have said in your life that you were not used to coming out and having conversations and talking about, but you have become quite adept at it, and you were a wonderful guest this evening. And I thank you, Liz Player, because you really painted a wonderful picture of what this organization is about and what you all are trying to achieve and are achieving. And I thank you for that. I look forward to meeting you physically in a few minutes when we go on Zoom, because I want the audience to know that we really created this relationship through a mutual friend, Elisa Midlowski, because she and I both belonged to the League of Professional Theater Women in New York City. And she said, she just mentioned to me, you really need to talk to a friend of mine, Liz Player. And I said, and why is that, Elisa? And she said, oh, because, you know, she started this chambers organization and you would really be interested in it. And I'm really glad that I followed through and you followed through and we got to the point where we are sharing this information to people who I don't know would normally get it. And so I thank you for being so articulate and so free with your information and your history and everything else this evening. It's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Lenny. It was an absolute pleasure and honor to be on your show.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Well, you're not finished yet. You got 10 more minutes on that Zoom. And then I'm going to let you go.
Sure.
I always feel so guilty. I go, I take an hour of your life, and then I ask you for 10 more minutes. But it is one of the things, when I post it, it sometimes the people will go to the video first, and when it then piques their interest, and then they'll go and listen to the whole radio program. And then from the radio program, they go on to really research some of the subjects that we have. So I'm so very pleased. So I thank you for this. I'm going to start to close it down this evening. I want to thank my audience, and I think the board, we didn't give you a lot of chance to ask any questions, but I didn't see anybody press one. So the board is pretty full. But everybody was listening, I think, to your journey, Liz. And I thank you all for listening to us for this evening, this hour. I would like you all to know that we're going to have a show next week. We're going to feature a wonderful woman who's been a lovely force in my life. Her name is Heather Rodale, and she is from Pennsylvania and a prominent family here. And we're going to talk about how the arts has influenced her life and the organizations that she has created. So, and she is not an artist of any kind. So it's going to be interesting how the arts does influence the lives of people who are in the industry and who are out, and how we must really all decide to sustain the arts because it's for the betterment of mankind. And so with that, I thank you and ask you to tune in next week. After that, I'm going to take a bit of a hiatus for a couple of weeks, and then you'll see me after the July 4th holiday, and I'll be back with a bang. I've got some really wonderful guests that are coming right on in after that. So with that, I'll see you next week. And Liz, I'll see you in a few minutes. And I thank you all for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey, Straight, No Chaser. Thank you.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, cause they don't know how to love you far away. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night. Bless my soul, I love you, just take this heart away, and you can take these arms, cause I'll never use them, just believe every word that I say. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, in the morning.